The multiverse view, or pluralism, is more often called set theoretic pluralism, is the view that there isn't just one true set theoretic reality, but rather a kind of plurality of different set theoretic concepts, each giving rise to their own kind of set theoretic truth. The way it's often described, set theoretic pluralism, it's not about the theory and our descriptions of the theory. Rather, it's a kind of reality base. There are different concepts of set that give rise to their own independent set theoretic world, so to speak.
Hey folks, sorry for this little break. Our first season was supported by the Akademie der Wissenschaften in Hamburg, but since this support ran out, we are now looking to crowdfund our little endeavor here. So if you want to chip in and feel particularly generous, feel free to go to buymeacoffee.com/aboutlogic and contribute whatever you would like to. Thanks for your support, and now back to the episode.
Hello, yeah, welcome to About Logic, and we are very pleased to have Joel Humpkins here, who is professor at the University of Notre Dame, which is not in France, but in close to Chicago, I understand. And very nice, pleased to have you here, and you previously were at the University of Oxford. This is correct, yeah.
Okay. That's right, yes, I was in Oxford. And before that, I was for many years in New York City, at the City University of New York.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we haven't met in person. We had one discussion on Twitter, maybe it was called X, I don't know. Let's see, maybe we can get back to this and continue this. Let's see.
Yeah, but maybe let's start with another question, and that's maybe one of the multiverse view, because we never had a guest that was requested so often, and the multiverse view was already mentioned in more than one podcast. Some of them are not published yet, but they will eventually be. So may I ask you to explain for our audience, maybe assuming that they already know that CH is independent, and they heard that there is this forcing construction, what is the multiverse view? How much does it entail? Are all universes still classical? And maybe also, is it about the models themselves, or is it about the whole multiverse as one thing, or how to imagine that?
Right. Well, that's a great question. So we're just going to jump right into it. Right. So the way I think about it is one wants to get straight on what mathematics is about. So what are we doing when we're doing mathematics, and what is the subject matter? And in set theory, I think the situation maybe for a long time is quite different from in other parts of mathematics. But there was, when I was a graduate student, for example, the kind of pervasive view in set theory was that, look, set theory is about the set theoretic universe. There is this one true set theoretic universe that we're trying to understand the nature of the truths of that universe. Maybe it's something like an attitude that people have about the natural numbers. It's quite common that there is this thing, the natural numbers, 0, 1, 2, 3, and so on, and it has a certain arithmetic structure, and there are truth values, so any arithmetic statement has a definitive truth value in that structure. Okay, this would be a kind of arithmetic version of the universe view, that there's a kind of singular reality to arithmetic truth, and it was quite common years ago in set theory that a similar situation was holding in the set theoretic universe. So every set theoretic statement, according to this universe view, would have its ultimate truth value, and we were trying to figure out what those truth values were and what the theory was. And of course, Zermelo-Franco set theory is part of that picture, but large cardinals and so on were probably also part of this picture. And so the idea is that on the universe view, we're sort of converging to the one true set theory. Okay, the multiverse view, or pluralism, is more often called today. Set theoretic pluralism is the view that there isn't just one true set theoretic reality, but rather a kind of plurality of different set theoretic concepts, each giving rise to their own kind of set theoretic truth. It's just kind of, the way it's often described, set theoretic pluralism, it's not about the theory and our descriptions of the theory. Rather, it's a kind of reality base. There are different concepts of set that give rise to their own independent set theoretic worlds, so to speak, and those worlds come to different truth values for set theoretic assertions, such as the continuum hypothesis, or maybe even the axiom of choice, or large cardinals, or any of the other statements that we know are independent. I find it helpful to think about the case of geometry, the analogy with geometry. I mean, for thousands of years, geometers thought of geometry as the study of the one true geometry, the geometry of physical space. I think it was a very common view. That's what they were doing in classical times and all the way up maybe until the 19th century. There was still this idea that there was only one geometry, and that's what the subject was about, finding the geometric truths in the one true geometry. But of course, then with the discovery of non-Euclidean geometry, the concept kind of splintered into several different geometries. We have Euclidean geometry and hyperbolic space and spherical geometry and so on. And there's a lot of different geometries now. But we think of those geometries as fully real. I mean, the geometers maybe tell us what it's like to inhabit hyperbolic space, and they get intuitions about the nature of this kind of geometry and what it's like to walk around in that kind of space and so on. And so it's not just about the theory, it's about the reality, the mathematical structure. So it's a kind of realism. It's a plural realism about geometry, because we have different concepts of point and line and the other geometric concepts. And they have different natures in these different geometries. And so basically, I think almost everyone is a pluralist when it comes to geometry. And I like that example because, oh, go ahead.
Sorry, I just had an association, if I may mention this. I mean, actually, if you look at general relativity, it seems that our actual geometry is not Euclidean, but it's some manifold with some rather complex structure.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, it's not even any of the other ones. It's not, you know, it's not hyperbolic space or something. I mean, it's not nothing like the Poincaré disk model or anything like that, maybe locally or something. But the geometry of physical space is totally weird, and it's modified by the presence of matter and so on. And none of the mathematical geometrical models are anything like that. I mean, you have to have the physics model, basically. And so there's this sort of severing of the connection between the mathematical theory and physical reality. And I think most geometers today, if they're looking at these various geometries, aren't confused by this anymore. They wouldn't say that, oh yeah, I'm studying the nature of space in physical reality. They would say, no, I'm studying this geometry or that one, and I define a collection of, geometric transformations. My geometry is defined by this, by invariance under, say, these various kinds of transformations. I mean, in the Erlangen program, this is a way of defining the geometry by its symmetries in this respect, right? That's a kind of abstract mathematical project which doesn't necessarily have anything to do with physical reality, as far as I can tell. Although, of course, it's very helpful for the physicists to have that knowledge when they're coming up with their more physically realistic models for physical reality. So I think of it, this analogy, it's happened in set theory now in the same way. I mean, there was a kind of independence kind of crisis where, you know, set theorists have come to discover that basically almost everything is independent of the Zermelo-Frankel axioms. I mean, in the same way that the parallel postulate was observed to be independent of Euclid's other axioms, but it's much more robust phenomenon in set theory because we have hundreds of thousands of independence results, not just this handful. And so this leads very naturally to the idea that, well, there are these different concepts of set and different set theoretic universes, and they have different set theoretic truths in them. And so this is a kind of fundamentally different picture about what the subject is about. What are we doing when we're doing set theory? Well, you know, we're studying the nature of these truths in these various universes, and there's quite a lot in common to them. I mean, maybe a lot of them have ZFC, for example, and then we would be proving theorems in ZFC that would tell us a lot about a lot of these multiverse conceptions of set. But maybe they don't all have ZFC. Maybe choice is failing in some ways, or we, you know, we get rid of power set and so on. So there's this variety of different theories that we might have. In them, maybe a lot of them have large cardinals and so on. And so So the project is to figure out what's going on in set theory generally, keeping in mind that there are these different concepts of set that give rise to these different truths. I'm not sure if that is an answer to the question.
I think it was very interesting exposition. But what I wonder, that sounds to me almost close to a more constructivist point of view, that we're not talking about things out there, but we are really constructing something which we then call sets. And there are different ways we can go. It's a sort of evolving subject. But you stick to the sort of classical interpretation, right?
I think there's an affinity there because constructivists are generally looking at situations where there's sort of multiple interpretations of the subject matter, and that's inherently pluralistic. But I think maybe I'm not an expert in constructive mathematics, and I'm a logician and aware of certain things, but I don't generally work in constructive mathematics at all. I think there's a difference in that constructivists, as far as I can tell, are also very concerned with our reasoning process in those different theories. It seems like much of the explanation that's surrounding constructivism is about the sort of process of deduction rather than the nature of reality itself. It's less grounded in, it seems to me, it's less grounded, at least historically, much less so grounded in a kind of semantical account of truth, but rather in a kind of grounded in the proof theoretic deduction process. Yeah, this is much less true though with toposes and so on, where we do have these different constructive models. Please. Yes, you're an expert on this.
I'm not. I'm very naive as what philosophy is concerned. But my interpretation is that that mathematical knowledge is evolving, and it's more like storytelling. Yeah, we tell a story, and there are different ways we can go, and hence the question of truth seems to be rather problematic, because in a story, certain facts may not be known. I always use this example. Did Captain Ahab have a blue shirt? I mean, for Moby Dick. If we don't know, right. It's neither true nor false, because it's not mentioned right in the story. Yeah. So if we view mathematical discourse as storytelling, then the principle of excluded middle seems to be rather problematic, and we can only use what's known as sort of Kripke models, which or embed models, which sort of reflect the idea of storytelling, unlike truth tables. So that's my personal view on this.
Right. I think that sounds right. And that's sort of what I was trying to allude to, because this strikes me as a kind of very common view amongst the mathematicians working in constructive mathematics, is to have some kind of story like that. And it's exhibiting exactly what I was trying to talk about. Namely, it's not grounded in an objective reality, objective realities, in the way that, say, when you think about geometry, different geometries, you know, I have a picture of the Euclidean plane, and I can imagine, you know, hyperbolic space in various manifestations. And it's not, I don't think of it as a kind of story. I think of it, those as just different physical realities, which have objective truths under, you know, going on in them. And I also think about set theory in the same way. So I don't take myself to be telling the story of what it's like, say, under ZFC plus a measurable cardinal or something. I just think that some of the set theoretic realities have measurable cardinals in them, and maybe some of them don't. And also, I guess it's an unfortunate coincidence of this word construction, because of course it has the precise meaning in constructive mathematics in the connection with intuitionistic logic and law of excluded middle and so on, but it also is used sort of in a softer way, I think, in mathematics generally, just to refer to the idea of a construction of some kind. And And a lot of these universe construction methods that we have in set theory, you know, like forcing and so on, or inner models or truncation models and so on, ultra power models and so on. These are all methods of constructing different models of set theory from a given model. And so the situation is quite interesting because it's that if you have one kind of set theoretic reality, then oftentimes you can define others by reference to it, you know, interpret the other model inside of it and realize this other model as this kind of genuine place, a genuine realm of set theory in which there would be an object, you know, if the given model has objective truth values and so on, then the interpreted one would as well. And so if one has a view of the set theoretic tools that we've discovered, you know, throughout the latter half of the 20th century, forcing and all these other model construction techniques, which are quite sophisticated, and those are the tools by which we discovered the independence phenomenon in the first place, we can see what's going on. And set theory has become the process of constructing all these different models of set theory, and we can think of them as real. Just like it's like having different groups or different partial orders or something. And so what I'm trying to say is that you described a sort of fictionalist idea. I mean, this is in philosophy of mathematics. This is the philosophy of fictionalism, where you think of mathematics as sort of telling a story. But this isn't required for pluralism, I think. This also, mm-hmm. one can just have a kind of realism-based view of pluralism, like we have in geometry, and this is what I defend also in set theory.
I mean, you coined the term full-blooded Platonism at some point, right? So it's even more Platonistic than the classical Platonist, because it's a little more laissez-faire. We have much more structures, and we take all of them serious, so to speak, rather than maybe saying all of them are non-standard, but the real universe.
I think that's right. Go ahead.
Okay, sorry. At some point, I maybe a naive question, maybe I'm completely wrong, so the answer could simply be no. I will know much less about your potentialist work, which might fit better to this view, because it feels a little more dynamic, even though, of course, you can always step back and say it's not dynamic, it can always exist, and I just speak like things evolve, but it's not really like that. Is that more fitting to this fictionalist speech, or is that?
Oh, I see. Oh, that's quite interesting. Yeah. So I think of. So I know that because you work with Benedict Love, you're familiar with this model logic of forcing, which is one manifestation of pluralism, but it's definitely not the only one. I mean, the sort of pluralist perspective in set theory is that there's all kinds of different models of set theory, however we might construct them, and sometimes they're constructed in other ways besides forcing. Let me just remark on this Platonism, because you mentioned full-blooded Platonism, which is, of course, a term that goes back to Mark Balliger and his book on the matter. So it used to be in set theory that if you said you're a Platonist, that it implied that you also had the universe view. When I was a grad student, that's what people meant. When Bob Solovey, you know, talked about Platonism, he always meant it means there's a singular set theoretic reality. But I think now we've changed this, and Platonism is, as it should be, rather about the realism of the underlying conceptions rather than about the singularity of the uniqueness. Yeah. So I consider myself a Platonist, even though there's different set theoretic universes. So we sever the connection with uniqueness. It's about realism, which goes back to this fictionalist question. Yeah. So is our understanding of the foundations of mathematics, you know, based in fictionalism or, say, formalism or something? Is it about the reasoning process? Are there genuinely real set theoretic realms that we're trying to study, right? And so Platonism is in the latter case and not so much in the former cases, right? So it's not necessarily connected with singularism or monism. Right, so full-blooded Platonism has a lot of affinity with this pluralist view. I mean, it's explicitly pluralist. So about potentialism, really, this is another issue. So I've done a lot of work on set theoretic potentialism and also arithmetic potentialism and so on. And the idea is, it's going back to Aristotle, of course, this distinction between potentially infinite and actually infinite, right? And but the sort of current thinking on potentialism is severing the connection with infinity. Really, what potentialism is about is your realm, is your mathematical realm completed or not? Or are there sort of partial universe fragments that can be extended? Yeah. And so, okay, in the classical view, what I call sometimes Aristotelian potentialism for arithmetic, you know, we have this idea that, well, you can, the numbers are infinite, you can have more and more, only finitely many at a time, but you can always have more, never completed, right? So the realms are the sort of finite, you know, finite bodies of numbers up to some point or something, and it can be extended further. But we can do this in set theory too. There's some very natural conceptions of set theoretic potentialism. So you could look at, say, even if you think there's a underlying reality for the set theoretic universe, the cumulative hierarchy V, you could imagine, well, it's growing, it's ever growing, it's never finished, but it can be made taller always. So like if maybe the realms would be some V alpha in the cumulative hierarchy, and you can access, you can make it taller, but you never get the whole thing, right? So this is one form of potentialism that's called rank potentialism. And that one, if you have the idea that the rank potentialist levels always, given any two of them, one of them is taller than the other, there's a linearity to it. And that leads you to certain modal principles. For example, if you have a concept of potentialism where the worlds are linearly ordered, then you're always going to validate S4.3. There's a modal theory, the 0.3 axiom is expressing this linearity. Yeah. But there's other kind of more radical conceptions. For example, if you look at forcing as a potentialist conception, I mean, in the modal logic of forcing, I think of it now explicitly as potentialist. You have models of set theory in the context of all of their forcing extensions. Yeah. And this is, it's actually not true in general that this is a convergent system. It's not directed. If you say take the countable models of set theory and look at the forcing extensions, then this is not directed. It's not convergent. So there's two extensions that can't be amalgamated. But nevertheless, it still fulfills the modal theory S4.2, which is exactly the modal theory that's valid on the convergent frames. So it's sort of convergent in the theory, but not in the semantics. So it's as though it's convergent. If I have a model of set theory, a countable model of set theory, or any model of set theory, and I have two forcing extensions that satisfy each of them, some necessary statement, then there's a single extension obtained by product forcing, which satisfies the conjunction being necessarily true. So I can sort of put them together. That's a kind of directedness or convergence phenomenon. So it's not linear. We get a different modal logic, S4.2. This is what Benedict and I proved. Yeah. So in the rank potentialism case, you get S4.3. But then if you just look at, say, arbitrary models of set theory under top extension, there might be different top extensions of a given model of set theory. So these are extensions that have more ordinals. Each of them has more ordinals. You know, then it's a theorem of mine that you get exactly only S4 being valid. So you don't have any amalgamation, there's no linearity and so on. And it's quite remarkable actually that you only have S4 in this case. So I think of all of those projects and that whole analysis, it's sort of evolving. I mean, we have now, there's a paper I wrote with one of my students, Wojciech Wojwoszyn, on modal model theory, where we provide tools for analyzing say the models of any theory, like graphs or groups or fields or whatever. You can take all the models of this theory and view it as a potentialist system where you take a model of the theory and it accesses all of the larger models into which it embeds. And you can understand, you know, what is the modal logic of group theory or what is the modal logic of graph theory and so on. And these are quite rich questions and extremely interesting to work out.
What does it tell us about the axioms, if we know that there is a certain modal structure on the models given by these ordinal right. extensions, right?
So you mean for which theories do we know?
I mean, if you tell me, okay, this axiom system has S4 or S3, I'm not a specialist on modal logics, but what does it tell us about the logic? I mean,
oh, I see. So right. So part of the part of what Benedict and I had done when we figured out the modal logic of forcing is that we introduced some modal vocabulary, which turned out subsequently to be extremely useful for understanding the logic of these other systems and categories and so on. For example, we have the concept of a button and a switch. And a switch is a statement that you can turn it on and off by going to larger worlds. So you have some potentialist system of possible worlds that you're thinking about. Maybe it's the models of set theory under the forcing extension relation. Or maybe it's graphs under the subgraph relation, induced subgraph relation. So you can add new vertices and new edges, but not new edges between old points. You know, so that's a potentialist system. Or maybe it's groups, you know, under the subgroup relation. So you can take a bigger group. You know, so a switch is a statement that you can turn it on and off by going to a bigger universe. You know, like for example, in set theory, the continuum hypothesis is a switch because you can force it to be true and you can also force it to be false and you can turn it on and off.
Independent.
Forever. It's independent, but independent it's not just statements. Independent. It's independent in this very robust way with respect to forcing, in that forcing can turn it both on and off. I mean, classically, we didn't need to force it to be true because we already had Gödel's theorem from 1938 that showed it's true in an inner model. So for independence, you don't need to force it, but it happens to be true. Not only Cohen's method not only shows that you can force not CH, but Salovey observed, you can also force CH. So you can turn it on and off by forcing, by going to a bigger universe always, you can change the truth value. Or for example, in graphs, think about graphs. You can always make it diameter 2 because I can add a new vertex and connect it to everybody. And now it has diameter at most 2. But I could also add a long chain and now it doesn't have diameter 2. So having diameter at most 2 is a switch in modal graph theory.
So all I didn't understand is, do you get this modal theory just from the first order axioms, or is there another ingredient, like how you organize the models, you relate the models to each
right.
other?
Oh, I see. Okay, so the proof, I mean, the modal theory is a theory not about one set theoretic universe, but about that universe in the context of all the other ones.
Yes, so I mean, these are first order models of the axioms of set theory. Right?
Yes, for example.
Well, do you see groups?
Maybe the accessibility relation would be a forcing, for example, or maybe it's top extension or end extension, or, you know, we have dozens of different extension concepts for models of set theory, and we've worked out the modal logic for each of them.
Yeah. So the modal logic is not just given by the first order theory, but you also need to add this extension logic, right?
Yes. Yeah,
okay,
exactly.
That's so to clarify.
Say, for example, take any first order theory T and look at, say, mod T, the class of all models of T, under, say, the substructure relation, the submodel relation.
That would be...
So every model accesses the bigger models into which it embeds, say. That's the possibility relation, the accessibility relation. And then you get, you know, that's a Kripke model, basically. So it has a modal logic. And the question is, well, what is that modal logic? And we've been able to figure out in a bunch of cases what it is. And there's a deeper connection now that Wojciech, my student, is thinking in terms of categories now.
I was just going to...
So basically, if you have any concrete category of L structures, say, a concrete category of graphs or of groups or whatever you like. So L structures,
by category, what do you mean? You don't mean category in the sense of category theory.
In category theory sense.
Yes, you do.
So if I have a concrete category, though, so it's kind of a set theory. Because what I want is that the morphisms are actual functions because they're providing counterparts concrete. For the individuals in the... in the worlds, right? Mm-hmm. So a category is a bunch of worlds which consists of individuals, and the morphisms are functions on those individuals, and those functions provide counterparts basically in the other models, right? And it reveals a kind of, when you're thinking about potentialism, there's this cleavage between the philosophers and the mathematicians, because in the sort of the philosophers who like to think about potentialism, they want the possible world and then there's a bigger world, but the old individuals are still there as themselves, right? Okay. Which means, in a sense, the morphism that they're interested in is the identity, you know, an inclusion map of a mm-hmm. kind, yeah? But it turns out that if if I have a bunch of graphs and I think about the subgraph relation, where it has to be, you know, identically a subgraph, not just embedded, but actually a subgraph in the sense that the individual, the points are the same points, then that mathematically, that conception actually has very poor amalgamation properties mm-hmm. because I can, mm-hmm. if I have a graph, I can extend it this way or extend it to a different graph using some of those same individuals, but in an incompatible way. And so I wouldn't be able to put them together, right? And so mathematicians generally prefer the embedding formulation where there's morphisms, and then we can have amalgamation, and then we can ask, well, does the diagram commute or whatever? And those all have consequences in the modal theory. So the philosophers like to think about the counterpart as identity, and the mathematicians prefer to have this kind of counterpart coming from morphisms, and then we have to discuss commutativity explicitly and so on. And you get better amalgamation properties. But it turns out, it's a theorem that I proved with Wojciech, that the modal logic, if I have a theory T and I take the models of T, then if I define the modal logic under inclusion or under embedding, the modal assertions are identical. The modal theory is exactly the same. And one of my other students, Sam Adam Day, proved, in fact, those two potentialist systems are bisimilar, which kind of explains why it's true that the modal logic is identical. You know, it's a sort of deeper explanation than Wojciech and I had. I'm not sure mm-hmm. if that is making any sense, that we've sort of gone to a different topic.
Yeah.
Can I do a tiny, tiny remark? And,
sure, yeah.
And we already mentioned Platonism and constructivism. Let me say, sometimes this has like a formalist flavor to me, because you and other set theorists are always able to reinterpret things. It's not so much the intended structure. It's like we have this formal system and we can look at it so different ways, and just stepping back and just putting in graphs there is so genius and insane at the same moment, right? It's such a nice example. It's so easy, but it feels a little formalistic as at times as well, because you are so able to change this perspective. Of course, I cannot, you can still be a Platonist and do that, of course.
Oh, I see. I'm not quite sure I get it. So you're saying that because I'm looking at sort of all graphs, and that somehow this means I must be a formalist, or?
No. I don't say that you are a formalist in any matter. I say it's so nice how you really look at the symbols without any intended meanings in that sense. So statement about the reality of mathematical objects or anything, completely right. Agnostic on the metaphysics.
I see. Yeah. Or but one could say pluralist instead of formalist, maybe. formalism can be considered a form of pluralism, I suppose, right?
I always thought that formalism is sort of like philosophical nihilism, you know? I mean, mathematics is only a game with symbols, right? So in my view, the people, I mean, start maybe, I mean, maybe I have a very naive conception of Platonism. They start with Platonism, that mathematical objects about like are real. They are like real things, like the sets, they are real in some sense, or at least it's a metaphor, I would say. But then they realize that this is maybe not very, not working very well, and they get completely disillusioned and become formalists and say everything is just a game with symbols, yeah. And I would hold in between is the constructive perspective to say, no, it's not just a game with symbols. It's part of our culture. It's evolving knowledge. but it is not fixed. It's always moving. So I don't know, how would you relate to this maybe?
Right, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think that formalism is sort of consonant with pluralism in the sense that, you know, your theory is not complete. And so there's going to be statements that you can't prove and that you can't refute. And so your theory could sort of be extended by adding such a statement or the negation and so on. And this partakes of this sort of pluralist manner of having lots of different worlds. I mean, regarding the sort of realism and Platonism, I think many mathematicians have the idea that they find it too difficult to undertake mathematics except by taking the subject matter in a realist way. I mean, when I'm reasoning about a mathematical structure of a kind, I mean, in a theory, even when I'm reasoning about it in a theory, then I'm sort of imagining the objects as being real and so on. And this is actually quite helpful for thinking about what's going on in the structure. It's giving me, you know, structural things to grab onto with my mind. I mean, and it helps me.
I can agree with this. Yeah, yeah.
But okay, ultimately, it's arguing in a theory. So I wrote a paper recently about arithmetic potentialism and the universal algorithm result. And a lot of the arguments in that, I'm thinking of a different paper on the linearity phenomenon in the consistency strength. And I gave some arguments in that paper arguing that certain things are not provable from this theory or that theory. And always I was defaulting to, well, take a model of this theory and argue about what's going on in that model. And was able to show that every model of this theory has this other thing happening. And so therefore that's a theorem of that theory, right? And the referee objected. The referee has more of a view like Thorsten's, maybe a kind of
theory.
Possibly. Yeah, maybe it was you. I'm not sure. And said, well, look, you're really just arguing in the theory. But somehow I felt it extremely difficult to undertake the proof that way by just thinking in the theory instead of thinking, I have the theory, I take a model of the theory. Now I have objects that I can reason about what they're doing and so on. I can live in that model and think about what it's like to live in that model. And that's how my argument went. But the referee was saying, well, you don't have to have the model. You can just argue in the theory, which of course is totally correct, except I would have never been able to come up with the proof if I was doing it like that.
No, I mean, explanations are very important, right? I mean, I don't mind a Platonist metaphor, right? I'm thinking that's the nature of mathematics. Yeah.
I missed the middle there.
I think a metaphoric use of Platonism I find completely useful and, as you say, helpful. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I would say if I step back and look what I'm doing, then it's not about things in the real world. It's just a metaphor which I use because I can think about the real world. I'm used to thinking about objects in the real world. So I use this metaphor to explain and to understand and whatever.
You know, I think that's totally right. And also, I think there's something more going on in that remark because the question is, what is the philosophy of mathematics for? I mean, we have these different philosophical views, you know, Platonism or fictionalism or formalism and so on. And they seem quite different, and so they're disagreeing and so on. But of course, mathematicians might have these different views, but they almost never disagree about what the theorems are, I mean, about the what's proven or not. And so one begins maybe to realize having a philosophy of mathematics isn't about telling you, you know, the nature of what's really true, but rather it's pointing you towards what is going to be an interesting mathematical project for you to undertake. So someone with the universe view in set theory, for example, that's their philosophy, they're going to be led to finding out these sort of sweeping fundamental principles that they would like to find true in that one true universe. And this is, for example, the kind of thing that Wooden is doing with his ultimate L program and so on. He has the universe view and he's trying to find out what are the truths in that one true universe. In a way, it's a way of understanding what he's trying to do and what he's motivated to do. Whereas someone with a the pluralist's view in set theory is going to be led to looking at, well, how, you know, if you have a lot of different universes of set theory, how are they related to each other? And this leads immediately to things like set theoretic potentialism and the modal logic of forcing and so on. And so it's not that, you know, we're somehow someone with the wrong philosophy is getting it wrong on the nature of mathematical reality. Rather, it's that philosophy is going to be leading them to certain kinds of projects, whereas a different philosophy might be leading them to other kinds of projects. Someone who finds constructive mathematics compelling is inevitably going to find themselves studying toposes that are validating intuitionistic logic, but not classical logic, right? And, you know, that's what is going to happen if you have that view. Whereas if you're following classical logic, then you're going to find those examples maybe less interesting or less compelling.
Okay, yeah, maybe we should, I would like to get back to our, maybe you don't remember, we had an interaction on Twitter, and I would like to get back. This is also maybe about different, you saying, okay, you accept pluralist view on the level of sort of axioms, foundations, but I would go further and say maybe there should be also pluralist view about the sort of logic we use for reasoning. Maybe that is already included. And at this point, it was about the question whether there's a difference between proof by contradiction and proof of a negation. And there is actually a paper by André Bauer about five steps towards accepting intuitionistic mathematics.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
He was previously on this podcast where he makes this point that we should actually distinguish these two. Because there is actually quite a lot of confusion because in mathematical parlor, these are often identified. Yeah. I mean, they're often not distinguished, which creates lots of confusion because people think, oh, if we reject, if we intuitionists reject the principle of proof by contradiction, hence they cannot prove that square root of two is irrational. which is not true, obviously.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
And at the time you said these two things are basically indistinguishable.
No. Well. Okay. So I think I remember this discussion very well, and of course I know André very well, and I've interacted with him quite a lot. He was a guest in my home in New York many years ago. He came to visit. Right. My view of the matter is that in constructive logic, of course, you want to distinguish between these two things because they're totally different. One of them is logically valid in constructive mathematics and the other one isn't. And that's very important in constructive mathematics to have a different view. Okay. In classical mathematics, however, this is simply not the case. And in classical logic, the two methods are basically the same method plus the idea that negation is a kind of duality and double negation isn't doing anything. And so if you think of the move, you know, double negation elimination as essentially logically trivial, which it is in classical logic, then the distinction between proof of negation and proof by contradiction totally evaporates. And I think that's the view that most mathematicians, classical logic mathematicians have. They don't distinguish between these precisely because they don't think there is a big difference between a statement and its double negation. They want to basically identify those two statements, and that makes the distinction evaporate. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, also, I think that maybe the constructive mathematicians overplay their hand if they want to say that certain proofs, which almost everyone agrees are proofs by contradiction, but aren't technically proofs by contradiction in constructive logic, such as the irrationality of the square root of two and other things.
The standard proof, the standard argument, right, assumes something is rational and then derives a contradiction. It's not like assuming the negation of a statement.
Right.
Proving it's wrong and then implying P.
I totally get it. It's proof of negation. It's not proof by contradiction according to the standard view in constructive logic, except that's not the meaning that classical mathematicians give to proof by contradiction. For them and for me, mm-hmm. and what I teach my students in my undergraduate classes is you're using proof by contradiction whenever you prove a statement by supposing mm-hmm. the opposite and getting a contradiction. And that includes proof of negation. Yes. Mm-hmm. So, okay, I'm not saying that the constructive mathematicians have to use this terminology. I'm just saying this is by far the most common understanding of what it means to do a proof by contradiction. It means you want to prove a statement, and so you assume the opposite of it. And whether that's adding a negation or removing a negation is sort of immaterial, because those are just trivially the same thing in classical logic.
Right.
And therefore, you know, and then you get a contradiction, and therefore you deduce the thing that you wanted. And so
I guess what I'm appealing is to take this possibility of constructive thinking. I mean, which sort of is sort of hidden in a way. I mean, even a classical mathematician may say, oh, we have an explicit witness of this. There is actually, there may in the meta mathematics make a distinction, but not in the actual logic. Yeah.
Right.
So, which I think is a weakness, but okay, that's my view. What I think is important is to be open to this pluralism, to say, okay, there are actually different ways to interpret logical connectives, and this leads in this case to distinguishing these two concepts, which I think is quite important to avoid confusion. I mean. That is recently I read a Gödel biography where the author also tries to explain intuitionistic logic, and then he claims that exactly this example, square root of two, rationality of square root of two, is not provable intuitionistic logic, because obviously this
Gödel
confusion
said that, really?
This confusion is quite widespread and creates a confusion about these pluralistic potential ways to interpret logical connectors.
I mean, obviously, in the context of any discussion involving constructive mathematics, you have to distinguish between these two things. I mean, this is quite obvious.
Okay, well, what I was asking is for any discussion of logic to acknowledge that there are different ways to interpret the connectives. I wouldn't ask everybody to become intuitionist. Yeah, that's okay. I mean, I'm not. Yeah, maybe after the revolution, okay. But okay. but
in the next life,
I appreciate some sort of pluralist presentation or understanding of logic.
Right, I see. That's quite interesting. So. I mean, I guess also I think that, I argued with Andre about this use of the proof by contradiction being strictly used in the intuitionistic sense. But I think it's harmful to say, for example, that many of the proofs that are conventionally regarded as proof by contradiction are not actually proof by contradiction. It's harmful for young people's understanding of mathematical principles to make a big fuss and say, well, that's not actually proof by contradiction, when they're supposing, you know, the opposite and getting a contradiction and then deducing that the thing they wanted was true. And I think it's actually quite robustly described as proof by contradiction. And so you say, well, this invites confusion, but I say, no, actually, to make this distinction at too early a stage in a context where there is no intuitionistic logic happening for these students, it's an entirely classical logic arena, then it's confusing not to call it proof by contradiction, in my view.
Okay. I guess we disagree.
We got the disagreement. So maybe something we hinted at quite a lot is this question of philosophy and math and how they interact with each other.
Sure.
And another thing is maybe in some sense we also talked about some historicity a moment ago, because in an intuitionistic world where Brouwer was more powerful and we all learned intuitionistic math, or maybe Heitinger, but whatever, and Hilbert wasn't that important or whatever, that doesn't matter. But there is we can play the game of contra-factual history and just say intuitionistic logic is thought to first year BA students, and then this distinction would make sense to have it there in this alternative world. And so you drew another alternative world, one where CH was settled, and then blog posts of yours. But I mean, that wasn't historicity in the sense that the math would have been different, right? The theorems would all be the same as today, but we would never have the multiverse view. Do you think you could elaborate on that a little bit?
Have
you imagined that?
Yeah, so this paper has now appeared in the New Journal of Philosophy of Mathematics, so in the first issue. So, so this is a sort of mathematical philosophical thought experiment that I had proposed. So I didn't want to suppose that any mathematics was different, but rather just the order in which the theorems were proved was slightly different in history, which would cause us to have a different view about what's fundamental in mathematics. And so my thought experiment was the following. Let's imagine back in the time of Newton and Leibniz that they were a little bit clearer about infinitesimals. You know? So, I mean, of course, we all know that they had found a calculus on infinitesimals and also that it was a little bit sloppy and people like Bishop Berkeley had sort of mocked them by pointing out these flawed foundations. Okay. Nevertheless, even those lousy foundations were extremely successful and they basically found all of the fundamental theorems of calculus, you know, quite robustly without any epsilons or deltas in that era. I mean, so it kind of, I sometimes say, well, this example shows, you know, do you need firm foundations to develop enduring mathematical theories of, you know, of enduring value? And the answer is apparently not, because in calculus, that's what happened, right? We had these very ambiguous and flawed foundations of infinitesimals in the early days, and yet calculus developed in a quite satisfactory and full, rich manner. Okay, but let's imagine they were a little bit better at infinitesimals. So what I posit is that, well, maybe they had some idea about sort of two number realms. There was the real numbers, and then there's this larger number system that had the infinitesimals in it. So that seems like a very slight kind of improvement on what they had. And we know that this improvement, of course, is fundamentally sound because we now understand the hyperreal numbers very well and infinitesimals and transfer principle and non-standard analysis and so on. So basically my thought experiment is to imagine they did a little bit better with infinitesimals with the two number realm idea. And furthermore, that they had this kind of beginnings of the transfer principle would be just the idea that everything that's true in the real number realm is also true in the larger number realm, which we might as well call the hyperreals. So something like a proto-hyperreal, proto-transfer principle. Also, you would know the hyperreals would be a real closed field and so on, because that's true in the real numbers and so on. And gradually, this idea would emerge of this concept of this hyperreal structure. And calculus would, in my thought experiment, be founded on this idea. So gradually, over a few hundred years, the ideas about this R star structure would become richer and more sophisticated, and the development of calculus would proceed along the lines of non-standard analysis. Then we wouldn't have epsilons and deltas and limits, but we would have the arguments, you know, with taking the standard part and so on, in just as we do in Robinson's theory. Okay, so then in the late 19th century, of course, we had these extremely important, philosophically and mathematically important results. For example, Dedekind gave us a categorical account of the successor function on the natural numbers, right? He proved that there's only one concept of successor on the natural numbers, fulfilling his three axioms. You know, zero is not a successor. The successor function is 1 to 1, and every set of numbers containing zero closed under successor contains all the numbers. So induction. That's a categorical theory. It uniquely determines the natural numbers up to isomorphism. And in my view, this theorem is the beginning of the philosophy of structuralism in mathematics, because he's identifying a structure not by giving us a kind of construction of what the objects are, like in the way that Frege was trying to do, but rather he said, no, it's this theory, and any two models of this theory are isomorphic to each other, and this is the essential nature of structuralism. Okay, Huntington proved in 1903 the categoricity result of the real field. It's the unique complete ordered field. Any two complete ordered fields are isomorphic. Okay, so we gradually started getting categoricity results for all of the standard, all of the mathematical structures, you know, in the pantheon, the natural numbers, the rationals, the integers, the real numbers, the complex numbers, and so on. We have categoricity results for all of them. But in my thought experiment world, the hyperreals are on this list, R star, right? It's one of the familiar mathematical structures used in the foundations of mathematics, and mathematicians would demand a categorical account of it in the same way that they did for all of the other structures. And it's possible to provide a categorical account. Dan Isaacson, a philosopher at Oxford, for example, really emphasizes the important philosophical role that categoricity results provide in providing meaning in mathematics. So the reason why we find it meaningful to refer to the natural numbers is because we have this categoricity result, and the same for the real numbers and so on, complex numbers. So the meaning and reference of those structures is grounded in the categoricity result. So we would need such a result for the hyperreal numbers, and it's possible to give it. If you write down the axiom ZFC plus the continuum hypothesis, then you can prove that there is only one up to isomorphism countably saturated real closed field of size continuum. So there's a unique smallest countably saturated field.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that proof requires CH. I mean, that theorem was actually proved in the 1950s and so on, but it could have been proved earlier because it's just a back and forth argument, which is similar to the Huntington result, similar to Cantor's proof of the uniqueness of the countable dense linear order. Except with countable saturation, now it's a recursion that goes for omega 1 many steps instead of just countably many steps. But it's the same kind of thing, the back and forth argument, but transfinite instead of only omega. So this theory would have provided us with the categoricity result for the hyperreals, which would have been recognized immediately as an essential fact for providing meaning in this concept that was totally at the core of calculus even. And so this is how continuum hypothesis would get on the list of axioms. People would recognize we need it to prove this theorem to give meaning to calculus. And so this is a thought experiment showing how it is that that continuum hypothesis might have come to be a fundamental axiom.
And what does that do to the pluralist story? Is now pluralist just a lucky coincidence and in a slightly different world?
Yeah.
We would never see this clear truth or...
Right. It's the question is, I take the argument to show that there's historical contingency in what counts as a fundamental axiom. Mm. And maybe you would argue, with your thought experiment about Brouwer taking power or whatever, this historical contingency in what are the logical truths, right? Or what is the logical system that we should all be working in maybe also has some historical contingency regarding that. But this, let me relate another story, though, about how this was received, namely this philosopher Daniel Isaacson, who I just mentioned in Oxford, subscribes to the universe view in set theory. And of course, if one argues that it's possible that something is fundamental and you take that as successful, then if you think there's only one universe, then you would think that it's actual. And so so he once described to me that, Joel, you've solved the CH problem because, you know, this is a reason to accept CH. I mean, not just in the thought experiment, but actually, we should accept CH because it provides the categorical account of infinitesimals.
And I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if there is an alternative sub-application or line of thinking which is not compatible with CH. I mean, I can't pull out one out of my head. But my observation is that actually I find this strive for completeness quite sort of a bit misguided, because I think incompleteness is actually beneficial, because you have got more applications for your theorems. Yeah, no matter in which direction you go, they will still hold, right? And so I think it's good to be incomplete. It's good to use Wigner theories. And I would even go so far is from a sort of intuitionistic point of view, I can distinguish propositions or statements which are indistinguishable classically, but which are important, especially if you work in connection with computer science or want actually to compute something, yeah, then these distinctions are actually essential in a way.
I totally agree with that. I mean, and this is basically an argument for pluralism also. I mean, that there's a sort of richness in the plural context that is absent in the monist context. But actually, I want to remark on something that you said, because you said weaker foundations, and it's something I've been trying to call attention to amongst the philosophers of mathematics. The dispute between weak and strong foundations, I think, is really core, and it explains so many other disputes, such as the dispute between classical and constructive logic, but also between the multiverse view and the universe view and so on. I mean, sort of mathematically, of course, when you prove a theorem and it's an implication, then it's a better theorem if you weaken the hypothesis, right, or strengthen the conclusion. That's a better theorem. I think this is a quite common attitude in mathematics. And I think it's maybe the same kind of attitude which makes one want to prefer weaker foundations. Well, we should have a weaker foundation as long as it's still sufficient to do the mathematics that we care about doing. And so I've heard many people say, well, we want, you know, ZFC is too strong. We don't need replacement or whatever to do the kind of, classical mathematical structures and so on. And I think this kind of explanation is part of this argument I'm trying to describe for weaker foundations. We want the weakest theory, which is strong enough to do what we want to do. I mean, you go even farther in your remarks by saying, well, actually, it's this sort of rich plurality, maybe, of foundations or different foundations. Okay, but let me give you the case that is sometimes made for the strong foundation. So one can find this case from the universe view set theorists are pointing out, look, these strong foundational theories, like with large cardinals and so on, have consequences for fundamental mathematical facts, even in arithmetic. They have arithmetic consequences. Or, for example, large cardinals have all kinds of consequences down low for sets of reals. Yeah, if regarding, say, measurability of certain kinds of sets. I mean, it was a classical problem in descriptive set theory in the early 20th century to figure out, you know, how complex can measurable sets be? How far can we push it? You know, Borel sets are measurable, and, you know, can we push it further to the analytic sets, or, you know, can we go up higher in the projective hierarchy? And it kind of stalled at a certain point. They weren't ever able to prove, you know, that these more complicated sets were necessarily measurable. And now we know this is independent of ZFC, but it's not independent of ZFC plus large cardinals. Actually, it's a theorem. If you have enough large cardinals, then every projective set of reals is Lebesgue measurable and has the property of Baer and so on, the perfect set property and so forth. So it has all these regularity properties. But these are things that we want to know. We want, like, that's a good consequence of those strong foundations, this to know that, well, whenever you define a set by quantifying over the reals and the integers, you know, then it's going to be automatically measurable. In practice, this is observed to be true. Whenever we can define a set like that, it is, in fact, measurable.
Right.
Okay, it's not a theorem, though, of ZFC, but it is a theorem if you have the stronger axioms. So
but
the point, I mean,
way.
If I could
so,
just finish okay. up, the sure. point is that what are the... It seems like this idea of weakening the hypothesis of an implication is not really necessarily appropriate for foundational matters. The argument for strong foundations is that we're going to be pointed towards fundamental truths that we would like to know about if we seek out strong foundations. But if you're never looking at the strong foundations, you're going to totally miss these consequences, which are actually quite welcome.
Yes, so my reply would be, there is another way to deal with exactly the situation you mentioned, which is synthetic mathematics. So like actually we do this a lot. We reason in this case type theory, but we reinterpret. We work actually in a model of type theory, and everything we do is closed under these principles. For example, maybe all functions are continuous. Actually, all functions are measurable. All types are measurable, and so on. And so inside the theory, we have these strong principles, but we can interpret them then in a much weaker theory and understand them. So this is actually very useful for actually quite complicated reasoning, because often all the details you would have to carry around if you do the reasoning concretely are getting out of hand. And doing this synthetic reasoning, it addresses both points. I mean, so usually justification is eliminates the boilerplate, all these complications. But the other one is also you do need to change your foundations. You do need to accept new fundamental principles. You just interpret all your theory, all your logical symbols in a different way.
But I don't understand how that method could ever get you to the claim, say, that every projective set is measurable. I mean,
yes, because all the sets you can construct are projective in the theory. I mean, if you look from outside, you can see that because you use some rather weak closure principles, you will always stay within this
line. But some of these statements that I'm talking about, though, have a large cardinal strength. So it's just not possible if you're in a situation where you know some of these statements, then it implies...
If the statements are about the real world objects, they need some strength, so you can't get this. But inside the theory,
I see.
Synthetically, you can create them. I just looked at a paper where there is a interpretation of measure theory inside type theory, and every type can be measurable. So it's unproblematic, because actually the foundations of type theory are so weak that you can interpret it in these different domains. So it's suitable for this kind of synthetic mathematics.
I see. That's quite interesting.
And Thorsten, do you want something to ask? Otherwise, I will continue.
Yeah, actually, this is related to what I just sort of introduced in a way. I always wonder, I mean, mathematicians or logicians often focus on like first-order logic and then maybe some axioms like ZFC as the way to do mathematics. And I find that in a certain way, I mean, we should not just be interested in like questions like consistency, but also how natural can we express our concepts. Yeah? And since you mentioned structuralism, I mean, I find that... for example, ZFC, that's set theory with predicate logic, is very in a way very low level, because you always can talk about the encoding of sets. I mean, for example, natural numbers, you have this von Neumann encoding, but then there are alternatives, and in a way, when I talk about natural numbers, I don't really want to talk about the encodings. I want to stay abstract here. So in this context, so the language of predicate logic is in a sense not so suitable. And we have alternatives when we have languages, like in this case type theory, where we cannot talk. I mean about the element relation, about natural anything that you prove upon natural numbers holds for all isomorphic structures automatic. This is this univalence principles. Maybe you've heard about this. So I wonder what's your comment on this? I mean, are you?
So I guess regarding set theory specifically, I think of set theory as really this kind of two aspects, two roles that set theory plays. And on the one hand, set theory is its own subject matter with its own questions and its own tools and methods and so on. It was born by considering the concept of transfinite ordinals, which is a concept that came out of Cantor's work on the Cantor-Bendixson theorem where he had at heart, you know, this is the result where you have a closed set and you remove the isolated points, and now you've got a new closed set and you remove isolated points again and you iterate this. But after omega many steps, you know, you might not be done because the intersection of all those might still have isolated points. You need to go transfinite. And so Cantor needed to invent the idea of ordinals in order to make sense of that process. And this is, in my view, the sort of birth of set theory is in this transfinite idea. And other people, Adrian Mathias, for example, describes set theory as the study of well-founded recursive definitions and constructions. And it's inherently about this sort of transfinite iterated processes, which is a very interesting, fascinating, and robust idea. And of course, part of that picture then is the cumulative universe of sets, which is itself the result of such a transfinite iterated construction of the power set operation. And so it provides this sort of framework for set theory. Okay, so there's many, many questions that arise in set theory about the nature of transfinite iterated construction. But on the other hand, set theory also happens to serve in this almost philosophical role as a foundation of mathematics. It was found itself quite convenient for that matter. And the reason for it is that mathematicians noticed that essentially any mathematical structure of any kind can be interpreted in set theory. And this is making it very robust. And also, important. It was important in mathematics to have a foundation, a single foundation. I mean, not a single one, but to have a foundation that into which all of other mathematics could be interpreted was important because, you know, you want to prove the fundamental theorem of algebra, but you're using methods in topology and so on. You know, you're borrowing theorems from another subject and applying it in this subject. And that's incoherent unless you have a foundation in which you can view both subjects as taking place. And set theory was able to serve in that role. And I think it's very important to distinguish these two roles because like the concerns about junk theorems and so on are really only, they're only about the foundational role of set theory, whereas the subject of set theory isn't actually so much about that. Rather, it's concerned with these other mathematical ideas and transfinite recursive constructions. And
My point was about the third aspect, right? Which is quite natural. So from the point of view from computer science, where you have programming languages which support abstraction, like high level languages, and then you have low level languages which are not very good or very brittle. They're not modular, and in my view, set theory is not very modular in the sense that it doesn't support certain kinds of abstractions, which I find are very useful.
So I think that's probably right, because you know, you wouldn't want to look at some theorem in field theory translated into the language of set theory. That would be ridiculous, of course, and also no one ever does that. And so it is this very low level thing. But the advantage of the fact that set theory is this very low level kind of structural idea, you know, there's only one type, everything is a set, and there's only one binary relation, you know, the set membership relation, and everything is built on that. What it enabled, however, was a spectacular meta-mathematical analysis and the independence results. And it's difficult to imagine such a successful implementation of those foundational ideas about independence occurring with some of the other, you know, much more elaborate foundational methods. So I think it's part of the explanation of the success, the meta-mathematical success of set theory in terms of identifying, you know, the independence phenomenon and those matters. And, you know, okay, one can say, well, look, we have, you know, hiding value, Boolean valued models and so on in these other contexts and so on. But one can also view a lot of that work as derivative of the work that had already taken place in set theory. So we wouldn't have discovered it directly, I think, without the set theoretic perspective, perhaps.
First of all, I would not diminish the historical role of set theory, as you also say, bringing forward foundations, which I think is important. And I do, and it's also what we do, we reduce to one set or one foundation only it turns out to be set theory. Yeah? I mean, set theory with predicate logic, as you say, is very syntactically convenient, very, very small. But it's maybe not conceptually convenient, right? The way things are constructed are a bit strange in a way. And if you,
I want to push back on that because I mean, I think part of the success of set theory is that it did provide the tools for our understanding of, you know, what is a partial order? Well, it's a set of objects with a certain binary relation, and those are very easy to implement in set theory.
And they're very easy to implement in my favorite theory.
No, I agree,
as well.
But to say, well, however, it makes it complicated is, I don't think it's accurate.
Okay. I mean, what I'm referring to is if in the set theory, I would talk about x, y, a natural number, x plus y equals y plus x, then I really quantify implicitly over all sets, which turn out to be element of the set of natural numbers, right? And I find so set theory in my view in the beginning is about collections. So if you just talk about what are collections, how can we form collections, and separate this from a set is the same as the proposition, the Cantor description of a set. You end up with a theory which is much better behaved for mathematical abstraction, right? Because you cannot talk about enkönigs. Yeah? You don't really want to talk about the elements of the set of natural numbers in a way, but in the type theoretic foundations, elements are part of the syntactic structure of your mathematical argument, and hence you cannot look into their structure. You can only talk about them in a structurally invariant way, which I think is preferable. If you actually want to do mathematics, and that's what we actually do when we formalize mathematics, then being not modular, being able to be independent on encoding, makes your theory your abstraction process much harder. So this is a different aspect of a foundation, right? It's not about as you say these transfinite structures or these other aspects, but it's a third aspect, which is how modular, how cold, how well is abstraction supported.
Right. So I guess I would respond to that by saying, there's maybe two different perspectives on what sets are about. And the picture of set theory that comes from, say, from the category of set is that points are sort of homogeneous, and a set is just a collection of these points, and we can sort of move them around, and we expect the universe to be sort of inherently homogeneous and have lots of automorphisms for that reason. Whereas the picture of sets that emerges from the cumulative conception of sets isn't like that at all. It's completely rigid, in fact, because it's part of the idea of sets that they're appearing in this hereditary accumulation process, and the role that a given set is playing is not just about its elements, but also its hereditary element structure. That's inherently part of the picture of set theory under the cumulative hierarchy. And you might say, well, I don't want to interpret mathematics in that picture because it doesn't have the right kind of homogeneity properties that I want. I don't want to ever look deeper into the structure or the internal structure of the elements. Whereas in the cumulative hierarchy picture, every set has this inner structure. And so sure, there's these other foundations. Now the question is, do we really want a foundational system in which objects out of which other structures are built are homogeneous or not? And are there advantages to having that kind of homogeneity, right?
Actually, I mean, I would give it a different description. I would say when you write mathematical statements, there is some aspect of it which I call type. I mean, x, y, in natural numbers, now I can apply the operation plus to it, right? But if I do x plus y and y is a Boolean, then this is a nonsensical statement. Yeah? And the question is, so you would say like a nonsensical statement is a statement which syntactically doesn't make sense. I mean, it has no meaning. But I would go further and would say a statement which doesn't treat these collections or types in a coherent way is meaningless, yeah. So you build in this structure of typing in your theory, and one benefit is that you can do it in a way since you cannot talk about elements, because the element relation is now judgment is something which is part of your syntax. It's not part you can reason about. You cannot say if X is an element in this type, then whatever. That's not something which you can express. But actually, it turns out you don't need to express. You can do mathematics very, very, very well without this feature. Yeah. But it supports abstraction in a better way. Yeah. So that's a bit of a orthogonal consideration, I would say.
Right. No, of course, that's totally right. And I'm never criticizing type theory or the other sort of alternative foundations. They're quite robust for what they're attempting to do. Sometimes, for example, people talk about this issue and they use the phrase junk theorem. And I think it's adjacent to the concepts that you're talking about, where the problem with interpreting, say, numbers as von Neumann ordinals.
It's to a subset of three.
Right. Is to a subset of three, or an element, or is one equal to the power set of zero, and so on. Okay.
Yeah.
But, okay, my view on this junk theorem is that every foundation is going to have junk of its certain kind. Even type theory has junk. Mm. For example, you know, if I have type theory, okay, I'm not expert in type theory, but I believe, you know, when you're defining certain types, maybe you define types for, say, ordered triples in terms of ordered pairs. You know, there's going to be a certain nature in that definition. There's a couple of different ways you could do it. You know, you could say an ordered triple is a pair consisting of a pair and another individual or something. Or you could
these
do it the other way.
These two are actually equal.
And what's that?
These two types are equal.
Okay, so when you write down the definition, then you have to, you know, you could write down an alternative definition, and you need to sort of prove, okay. Mm-hmm. But this is kind of junk, and it's just also coding in exactly the same way that sets are doing coding, I think. It's coding in the type definitions. And so the question is, well, where are we going to put the coding? This coding is inherent in mathematical activity. I have a concept, maybe it's expressed in type theory. I define other concepts relative to it by defining new types and so on. And maybe you say, well, no matter how you do it, I'm going to prove that they're homotopic and whatever. But nevertheless, the definition was in a particular detailed way, and I need to prove that that agrees with the other ways of doing it, and that's the coding. And I think it's inescapable.
You're right to some degree. Intentionally, these things are different. Like, for example, these different encodings of triples are intentionally different. And if you prove something, you have to take care of this intentional structure.
Right.
But mathematically, but they're not different. And this is actually a consequence of this univalence principle. Mathematically, they're actually equal. And this is because I can never actually talk about the encoding. Right? So that's the power of what's now called homotopy type theory. Maybe I've heard about it.
Maybe that's something for the next episode.
Okay,
I would love to continue this, and I have like 12 other questions. You are collaborating with so many people. You are doing lovely stuff. There are these Koepke Turing machines. There are your Turing machines, transfinite computation. So many more things to ask, but we are out of time, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So let me say two last things, and that is, We were a little unfair to you because we jumped so many topics. We forced you to jump into so many different research programs. And maybe we were unfair to our audience because you're also great in giving the introduction to logic and foundation and philosophy of math. And I mean, there are at least two proofs of that we will link into in the comment section, in the description. And one is your, and maybe you can help me if I butcher the title, your introduction into the philosophy of math that you wrote
Lectures on the Philosophy of Mathematics.
Yeah, and this is really a great book. It's also for the pure philosopher accessible. And then there is another book. Am I correct that this was born out of a series of posts that you then re-merged to one book on infinities, or am I wrong?
So the
with
book
that?
Is called The Book of Infinity, and I had written this book in preparation to give in my infinity class here at Notre Dame. And I serialized it on my Substack, so the chapters as I wrote them were appearing. So I was conceiving it as a book from the start and releasing the chapters one at a time. And now I have several other books that are being released that way also on my Substack, infinitelymore.xyz.
Okay, that's a great resource. You should visit that one. We will also link to your blog. And we hopefully have you here again.
I'll be back. Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure talking with you. And obviously, we have much more to discuss and argue about.
Yeah, that's probably a pleasure.
Thank you very much. Yeah. It was really a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Yeah, indeed.
Thank you so much.
So let me say to the audience, don't forget to comment, subscribe. We will answer in the comments and see you at the next episode.